Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome the listeners of WUSM-FM in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, one of the more than 225 radio stations carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. A native of Dublin, Ireland, today's speaker earned his bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from University College in Dublin in 1968. Upon graduation, he began his career with Chevron Research as a process engineer. After serving in positions of increasing responsibility, our speaker was named general manager of Chevron's refinery at El Segundo, California in 1986. He also served as manager of manufacturing for our chemical olefins division in Houston, manager of the Salt Lake City refinery, plant manager of the Richmond, California agricultural chemicals plant, and on the corporate foreign operations staff. In July 1989, he was elected senior vice president and chief operating officer of Chevron Chemical Company. In October 1991, today's speaker was elected a vice president of Chevron Corporation, responsible for strategic planning and coordination of the company's quality improvement activities. He also served as a director of Caltech's Petroleum Corporation from March 1992 until September of 1994. In September 94, he was elected president of Chevron Products Company, responsible for the company's United States refining and marketing operation, and in November of 98, was elected as vice chairman of the board. From November 1998 until January of 2000, he served as one of the company's two vice chairmen, responsible for Chevron's worldwide exploration and production and corporate human resources, and then assumed his present position as chairman of the board and chief executive officer of Chevron Corporation in January of this year. He is a member of the American Petroleum Institute's board of directors, the board of the National Action Council for Minorities in Engineering, the San Francisco Symphony Board of Governors, and the Bay Area Council, and also a member of the Business Council and the Business Roundtable. It is with great pleasure that I introduce to you Dave O'Reilly, who will speak to us today on the topic, What's Up with Oil? Prices, supplies, and technology in our energy future. Dave?
Thank you, Skip, for that nice introduction. And before I start, I'd just like to acknowledge a couple of people up here on the dais. First of all, my predecessor, Ken Durr, who a few months ago would have been the one giving this talk. And secondly, I'd like to also acknowledge to his right our good friend from the Freedom Fund, Shannon Reeves. We have a very good cooperative venture with Shannon. He drew our attention to the inner city of Oakland and the need for good quality services, good quality convenience stores, and we're very proud to be associated with him and his organization, and have found this to be a very good business proposition and something that I think is a model for other locations. Let me now turn to the topic at hand. When the Commonwealth Club first asked me to speak, I wasn't sure that anyone would want to hear about an old economy issue like energy, especially not from an old economy company founded in the 19th century, as Chevron was. The last time oil prices really hit the headlines was way back in 1981, where they hit an all-time high. And that got a lot of attention. Few people noticed it early in 1999 when oil prices, in real inflation-adjusted terms, hit an all-time low. All the latest business stories were about internet stocks, venture capital, IPOs, and dot-com millionaires. And then all of a sudden, energy was back on the front page. Oil prices reached a peak of $30 a barrel, in fact, over $30 a barrel just a few weeks ago, three times the level that they were in early 1999. Gasoline and diesel prices rose 50 to 60%. Airlines tried to raise ticket prices. OPEC's every move has made the news. Vienna, Saudi Arabia, etc. Truckers, farmers, and politicians have been protesting and finger-pointing. And in fact, in Washington today, the Senate is considering a repeal of the 18-cent a gallon federal excise tax. With all that background, has the energy crisis of the 1970s returned with its odd and even gas lines, with its 55-mile-an-hour speed limits and lower thermostats? Is this a case of deja vu all over again? I hope today to convince you that it is not. The world today is in much better shape from an energy standpoint than it was 20 years ago. Throughout the 90s, more countries have opened to outside investment in their energy sectors. And meanwhile, we've enjoyed enormous benefits from technology. We've seen major innovation in our industry, which has been fully embraced by our people, and including the tools of the information economy. Investment and innovation have been keeping energy prices affordable and supplies reliable, and they are, in fact, the keys to global energy security for the future. Let me put this in perspective. The world consumes about 77 million barrels a day of oil, and about one-third of it comes from the OPEC countries. In 1997, OPEC and some other oil producers decided to boost their output because they thought the market demand was increasing. This was a major miscalculation. OPEC pushed oil production up just as the Asian economies were starting to go down, along with their energy demand, and the result was a global oil surplus. Oil prices fell steadily through 1998, and early last year they hit a 70-year low of $11 a barrel. Gasoline prices in most states dipped below a dollar a gallon. The OPEC countries themselves were hit hard, losing about $50 billion in oil revenue, fully a third of their normal level. So in March of 1999, OPEC and two non-members, Mexico and Norway, agreed to reduce production. And within a couple of months, oil prices started to rise again. Ironically, OPEC took production down just as the Asian economies were starting to recover, along with their oil demand. The surplus disappeared, world oil inventories fell to historic lows, and the oil market reacted with over $30 a barrel oil. So in just 1 year's time, we went from one extreme to the other. This week, OPEC officially decided to raise production by about 1.7 million barrels per day. And this morning, Norway announced they would add 100,000 barrels a day, and I believe Mexico will add some production as well. The market saw that decision coming, and prices have now retreated to the $27 per barrel level. But we won't know the true impact of OPEC's decision for a while, partly because much of that new oil probably started entering the market earlier this year. We do know that it took us a long time to get into this situation, and history tells us it'll probably take some time to get out. We also know that OPEC will remain important. They control four-fifths of the world's known oil reserves, as well as most of the world's excess production capacity. And you might think that they're back in the driver's seat, just like 25 years ago. But let's take a little closer look. OPEC itself is a group of 11 very different countries, and they've had mixed success in trying to control the market. In fact, it took the lowest oil prices since the Great Depression for them to agree on the production cuts of 1999. Now, if you consider all the factors that OPEC does not control, these include changes in oil demand from economic growth or from advances in efficiency. They don't control the weather. A warm winter can have a big impact. Production rates in non-OPEC countries have been rising, and non-OPEC countries produce two-thirds of the world's oil supply. And then we have the lessons of the past. Back in the 70s, OPEC drove prices way up, and those prices stimulated conservation, they stimulated new investment in energy efficiency, and new production from other countries. When prices peaked in 1981, U.S. oil demand fell by 4 million barrels a day, a gigantic amount, and then ultimately in 1986, prices collapsed. And since then, except for the Gulf War in 1991 and this latest spike, oil prices have generally been flat to declining in real terms. Now, OPEC hasn't forgotten that chain of events, and today all the oil-exporting countries have something new to think about as well. Mexico is a good example. They sell 1 million barrels a day or so of oil to the United States, so they do benefit from higher oil prices. But Mexico today relies more on manufacturing than oil. The OPEC nations depend on their oil earnings, but they also know they need to diversify their economies, and for that, they need affordable energy, just like the rest of us. Add it all up, and we begin to see that OPEC has incentives for supporting moderate prices, as well as disincentives for giving us the opposite. OPEC's biggest producer, Saudi Arabia, has already been advocating price stability in the $20 to $25 per barrel range, and other producing nations have said the same type of thing. So the experts still believe that oil prices over the next decade are going to behave a lot like they did in the last one. So what does that mean to all of us here about supply and pricing and the like? Let me first say that despite some of the news reports earlier this month, the government is not forecasting a supply shortage. And to that I would add that except for safety, nothing is more important to Chevron than keeping our customers supplied. So now you might ask, at what price? We've seen a lot of volatility in the last year or so, from the very, very low to the very, very high, and lately, the very rapid as well. So it's understandable why customers are concerned. But if you've taken a closer look and kept up with the news reports, you know that gasoline is still a good value, especially when you look at the other items that you buy. Gasoline in the last 15 years or so is up only 7%. Take the taxes off gasoline, and the average price in recent years is actually pretty close to $1 a gallon. Compare that to milk at over $3 a gallon, or carbonated water at over $2.50 a gallon, and so on. If you just take the national average price for gasoline at about $1.60 to $1.70 a gallon and adjust it for inflation, it's actually cheaper than gasoline was in the early 60s. And meanwhile, average fuel economy has improved. So again, when you subtract the pump taxes, U.S. gasoline on average today costs just 5 or 6 cents a mile, and that's half what it cost 30 years ago or even 50 years ago. Now, California gasoline, however, is a slightly different story. It's costing us about 7 cents a mile. Now, that's still good value in terms of personal transportation, but the issue here in California isn't just price. It's the fact that we pay more than people in most other states. Our customers always and often point this out to us. Here's a line from an email I received just this week. I'm looking for a horse. It's a lot cheaper than operating a car. And the lady signed it, best regards, Teresa. Well, maybe she should. But seriously, though, let me tell you what we said in our reply. Let's start with taxes. California currently pays over 50 cents a gallon in taxes, the nation's fourth highest rate. In New Mexico, pump taxes are actually 15 cents a gallon less, and in Georgia, 20 cents a gallon less. So when you have those people that come from Atlanta and say, I paid 20 cents a gallon less, that's taxes, folks. We also have a unique California gasoline, which is mandated by the state to help us reduce smog. Compared to other states, the state estimates that it costs in the 5 to 8 cents per gallon to make. So that's an added cost. Having our own formula also keeps our market separate from the rest of the United States. So when supplies of our unique gasoline run short, prices can go up quickly. And it usually takes a while to bring in more supplies to meet that strict California standard and rebalance the market. So that's kind of the story from an OPEC perspective, the recent issues around crude oil pricing, and the impact on gasoline. Now, earlier I said that the world is in much better shape for energy than it was 20 years ago, so I'd like to turn to that subject again and point out that investment and innovation are the keys to continuing to have long-term energy security. Let's talk about investment for a moment. The last decade, we saw a wave of countries opening their energy sectors to outside investment. Latin America, just next door, is a dramatic example. Argentina and Venezuela led the way, and now Brazil is moving in the same direction. Even more dramatic has been the fall of the Soviet Union. Almost overnight, the newly free countries in the Caspian region have started to build new energy partnerships, and they've attracted billions of dollars in private sector investment. One big success story has been the joint venture between Kazakhstan and Chevron to manage the giant Tengiz field on the eastern shore of the Caspian Sea. Another has been Chevron's leadership and investment in the Caspian Pipeline Project, which will bring that oil from the Tengiz field to world markets. The trend has also touched the major producers of the Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. They are either talking or starting to talk with foreign investors and are talking seriously about potential partners. Engagement, not isolation, is the new course. Countries once closed and global companies like Chevron are forming new partnerships. We're providing new capital, technology, and know-how to find new oil and gas fields and to get more production out of the older ones. The beneficiaries of this are not just the oil producers, but they're also the people and economies of the world, especially those in the developing nations who need reliable and affordable energy. Now, another reason that the world energy situation is in better shape today and will be in the future is technology. This is the innovation side of energy security. Economist Lester Thoreau has said recently that the oil industry, and I quote, has been infused by so many new technologies that it should be thought of as one of the new man-made brain power industries, unquote. Oil business today relies heavily on computers. Finding and developing new oil fields is a good example. The conventional view is that the world has enough oil to last way past the middle of the 21st century, and much of that is locked in older giant fields. Over the years, lots of people have predicted that we're going to run out of oil a lot sooner than that, but technology has always proved them wrong. The oil and computer industries actually began their long romance back in the 50s and 60s. And in 1985, Chevron was the first oil company to purchase a Cray supercomputer. Now, our computer guys at work tell me that that machine today could be outperformed by a Sony PlayStation. One of our newer tools is the visualization center we created in San Ramon with Silicon Graphics Company here in the Bay Area. Our scientists put on 3D glasses and analyze room-sized seismic images of oil and gas reservoirs from all over the world. This gives us a better idea of where our resources are hidden and shows us how to recover more oil for less cost. Another example of technology is that a lot of tomorrow's oil and gas will come from new fields beneath the deeper waters of the world's oceans. Chevron's new Genesis project in the Gulf of Mexico floats like a giant cork in waters more than half a mile deep, and it produces oil and gas deposits from 10,000 feet beneath the seafloor. Projects like this will serve the energy needs of millions of people around the world in the year ahead. But they wouldn't be possible without the computers and advanced technology to design, develop, and operate them. Elsewhere in our business, we're putting the World Wide Web to work. 3 years ago, we started to realize that by taking advantage of the Internet, we could change our business for the better. We've also felt that being close to Silicon Valley might give us an edge. So last year, we created Chevron e-Business Development Company. Their job is to find new efficiencies for us in the business-to-business sector, the so-called B2B trend we've all been hearing about. Also last year, we used web architecture to reinvent our business relationships with our service station dealers. We've streamlined our operations and reduced our costs. This month, we announced plans to use that same Internet-based model to create a company with Oracle and McLean called RetailersMarketExchange.com. It's a long word, but it's going to be the first full-service marketplace online linking suppliers with convenience stores and small retailers and branded marketers. In January, with our partner Ariba, we created an independent B2B company called Petrocosm.com, and we believe it can become the world's biggest shared marketplace for online procurement of oil and gas hardware and services. Indeed, B2B could help oil companies cut costs by 5 to 15%. And we're talking of billions of dollars here when you spread that over the whole industry. So technology has been a driving force for controlling costs in our energy industry, and I think that the energy prices that consumers have enjoyed throughout the 90s bear this out. In fact, in a recent study by Goldman Sachs, they said that oil companies over the last 10 years have passed 70% of their cost savings through to the consumers. This trend will continue with e-commerce, and I quote from the report, "The Internet will help oil companies meet the world's energy needs by ushering in the next wave of cost-cutting and productivity improvement." Now, earlier I said I wasn't sure that anyone today would turn out for a speech about energy, and I have to admit I've got mixed feelings about all this attention we're getting. On the one hand, I like it when customers just depend on us. Motorists pull up, fill up, and get on with their lives. Show me a customer in motion, and I know we're doing our job at Chevron. And I think maybe people don't need to know all the steps that are involved in getting that gasoline to the pump, the infrastructure, the markets, the oil fields, the geopolitics, the taxes behind every tank of fuel and every turn of the ignition key. On the other hand, I can't help but notice how we take reliable and affordable energy for granted. We seem to get excited mostly about it when the lights go down or the prices go up. This I find hard to accept because the central role of energy in fueling our economy is so striking to me. The world relies on oil for 40% of total energy and almost all of the transportation fuels such as gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel. Fuels made from oil give us our mobility, taking the kids to school, commuting. We put the fuel in the van and web van. We put the express in Federal Express. We all appreciate the gifts from Silicon Valley, all those wonderful products we can't do without, the miracle of infotech and the cyclone of e-commerce. But California's computers, printers, and servers don't really run on electricity. They run mostly on the natural gas and coal, the fossil fuels that fire the power plants that make our electricity every day. If you take a moment to look closely at energy, you will see that the new economy relies completely on the old, just as the old relies on the new. People criticize fossil fuels and the engines and power plants that burn them. But when we look at the benefits as well as the costs, we see that the marriage of oil and transportation and power generation has given us the modern equivalent of the magic carpet. Throughout the 90s, oil and energy, plentiful and affordable, have helped drive our phenomenal 10-year global economic expansion. And most experts see demand for all kinds of energy growing steadily over the next 10 to 20 years. The outlook is clear. To sustain our societies and improve people's lives in developing nations, we're going to need more oil, more natural gas, more power into the next century. I know that it's tempting to look at energy right now as the same old story. The price of the pump this morning, OPEC on one side and the American consumer on the other. But that view, like the Cold War, belongs to the last century, not the new one. In the past, when prices have gone up, they have eventually come down. And nobody knows for sure where prices will go next. But we do know that the forces at work today, the expanding marketplace, geopolitics, globalization, will all grow stronger. Together, they suggest that the polarized energy world of the 1970s is giving way to something new, a world where oil-producing nations seek a balance between the cheap and the expensive, a world where more countries will have a stake in both economic growth and the affordable energy required to get it, a world of energy security where investment and innovation will ensure that we keep supplies flowing, and a world that should work to the benefit of all energy consumers long after the price spike of the year 2000 fades into history. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave O'Reilly, Chairman and CEO of the Chevron Corporation, for your speech here today. And now, Mary Huss, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and publisher of the San Francisco Business Times, will conduct our question and answer session. Mary?
Thank you, Skip Rhodes, President of the Commonwealth Club. Mr. O'Reilly, we have got a number of questions for you today submitted by our audience. So, and many of them do have to do with pricing, although you've answered that fairly well. But I think one question that everyone wants to know, do you pay for your own gas?
Yes, I do. And I try to get the best price as well.
Okay.
By Chevron.
By Chevron. Many questions. People wanting to know why there is such a great and constant difference in the retail price of gasoline charged in the Bay Area compared to Southern California. And also, I'll just throw in another pricing question with it, is why, you know, when there are two Chevron stations four blocks apart, the price can vary by, you know, 5 or 10 cents a gallon.
Let me address the first one first. Bay Area prices typically are higher than those in Los Angeles, and there are some very good structural market reasons for that. Los Angeles, the barriers to entry are a lot lower. Land costs are lower. It's easier to build and develop service stations in Los Angeles. Also in Los Angeles, you can build a convenience store with your service station, so you can get added revenue to pay the rent on the land costs that you have invested in through leasing or purchasing. So that's a very important differentiator. Here in San Francisco, land costs are extraordinarily high. It's much easier when a lease expires to convert a station into an apartment building or into a store of some sort or an office building. So stations have been declining in number. In addition, we're not allowed to have full convenience stores in our stations or our dealers' stations, our business partner stations here in San Francisco. There's a limited amount of added revenue that they can get out of those sites. So, frankly, this is not a very competitive place to do business, and the returns on investments are lower, and therefore prices are higher. With regard to stations selling at different prices, most of the stations in the world are run by independent business people who make their own decisions about prices. And it's entirely appropriate. And if two stations are 5 cents apart, that's the marketplace at work. If one station loses more business because the station 4 miles away or 3 miles away has a lower price, then obviously that person will have to bring his or her price down to be competitive. So that's the marketplace at work. And to me, that tells me there's a marketplace when you see those price differentials. They're common to other products as well. Thank you.
We also have several questions just why oil prices are so much higher outside the United States, and, you know, does this have to do with have more heavy taxation, and do you anticipate a situation where gas prices in the United States might equal the levels that we see them in Europe?
The answer to the last question is no, not without a change in tax policy. As I said, taxes in the United States, in California, for example, are 50 cents a gallon, and they vary. You know, if you look at the tax part of the bill that you pay, it's hidden in the price. 18 cents or so in California is federal excise tax. That's common to the whole United States. In California, 18 cents state excise tax. And then we pay a sales tax of 8 or 8.5% on top of not only the basic price of the product, but the taxes, the excise taxes as well. Seems like it's almost unconstitutional, but that's what it is. So we have let's say we have 50 cents a gallon. Many of the European countries have four times that much built in into their prices. There's $2 taxes, $3 taxes are not uncommon. So when you go to the pump and they sell it in liters too to disguise it a little bit. Liters are smaller. But the fact is, if you go to a European country, it's not uncommon to pay $4 or $5 a gallon, but find that 80% of that is tax. And unless the tax structure changes in the United States dramatically, I don't anticipate our prices. I don't think that there's anyone in Congress who would get a vote if they were to support that sort of taxation. That's my view.
Okay. Well, now we have someone who wants to get very specific, and I don't think this will surprise you that it does come from the media. What is Chevron's profit per gallon for regular unleaded gas sold in San Francisco? And what was it 6 months ago? Has it changed and why?
I'm not going to comment on our exact profits by business segment because we don't disclose that for competitive reasons. But let me just get to the question and give you a kind of an average. Our profit per gallon in our refining and marketing business, and it's on our webpage if for those of you who want to dial into Chevron.com, over the last 8 years has averaged 2 to 3 cents per gallon on our refined products. That most of that is gasoline. The biggest single product that we're selling, of course, is gasoline. That's 2 to 3 cents per gallon. The fact of the matter is the refining and marketing business is very competitive, and that tells you that sometimes we've obviously lost money. If you go back and look at our history in our refining and marketing business, you can see some quarters in the last 5 years where we've lost money in the business. We have some business partners in the distribution and sales part of the business in this room today who I think can validate how difficult it is in a rising crude price environment to make money in the business of refining and selling gasoline in that environment. Sure, at times it's higher than that, and at times it's lower than that. California in general, the market varies, as I said, and we get higher prices in the Bay Area than we do in Los Angeles. We also have higher costs in the Bay Area than Los Angeles, but we don't disclose it in that our profits in that much detail. Thank you for the question.
All right. And another question, or a couple of questions regarding profits. Sacramento lawmakers are saying you're making windfall profits, and the public thinks the same. Are you making money hand over fist this quarter? And maybe explain why or why not. And second question is, what is your reaction to the threats by some legislators to impose a windfall profits tax? And I guess this person also wants to know what you paid for gas the last time you filled up your car.
Well, let me deal with the last one, $2.15 for a gallon of premium. That's the answer to the very last part. There were a number of questions in there. Let me start with the question of windfall profits. I'm not sure where this idea comes from. I've heard that there's a proposal in Sacramento to increase the taxes on oil companies. It's just counterintuitive. You increase the taxes, you're going to increase the cost, you're going to increase the price. People have to recover those taxes ultimately in the marketplace. So I think that's the wrong way to go. And I'm very puzzled by it because simultaneously in Sacramento we're talking about raising taxes and over in Washington we're talking about cutting them. It just seems ironic that nobody seems to know the right solution, which really is the marketplace. The marketplace will correct this problem. High prices attract more production, stimulate more investment, and will cause the prices to come down. It's a very competitive business. As to our profits, which was the very first question, there is no doubt that the first quarter of this year will be a better quarter for Chevron than prior quarters, particularly the first quarter of last year. We have many segments to our business. One of our big segments, of course, is exploration and producing. That's the finding and producing of crude oil. And gas at higher prices, that end of the business will be profitable. However, countering that, we have a mammoth investment, $6 billion investment in the U.S. refining and marketing business. And with that big run-up in crude prices, that will not be a profitable business. I can't predict profits for the quarter. I'm not allowed to do that. But please take a look at our earnings when they come out at the end of April, and you'll see what I mean by where the money is in the business and what the real returns are when you divide the profit by the total amount of money invested in the business. This is not a barn burner business from a return on capital employed or a return invested business, particularly in the refining and marketing end of the business.
Do you see the same performance and growth of stock prices in the oil industry in the next decade than in the previous two-thirds decades based on new technology, the economy, and more efficient uses of energy?
If I'll try to understand the question. it's the stock price performance, which is obviously of great concern. Until the last few weeks, I thought the whole oil industry was being ignored. The whole energy sector was being ignored as an investment opportunity. And our stocks, all our stocks have been down dramatically, like so many of the other, quote, old economy stocks or value stocks. We've obviously roared back here in the last few weeks. It's kind of ironic that as crude oil prices have come down in the last week or two, oil stocks have gone up, which I think tells you that people have taken a look at our segment of the business, of the business world, and recognize that energy has an important role to play in the future of the world, and that if the economies of the world do well, North America, Europe, Asia, Japan, and so forth, if these parts of the world continue to do well, it bodes very, very well for energy companies, because we need fuel to fuel that growth. We need energy to grow. And I'm bullish about our business. I think if the economic drivers remain good, this is a good business to be in, and we're well positioned to be in it. Our intent is to be a good performer, performer in the equity markets, and actually to be better than our competition. We've set a goal to be number one in total shareholder return during the period 2000 through 2004, the next 5 years, and we're going to deliver.
There are a lot of questions here about alternative sources of energy, and if you can talk a little bit about recent developments in the production of alternative sources of energy and what Chevron is doing in terms of research and development in this area.
There are a number of alternatives out there that are being worked in. We're active in a few. Let me just give you a summary quickly of the world's energy. About 40% of the world's energy is oil, about 20% gas, 20% coal. There's 8 or 10% nuclear, and then there's, you know, hydropower and a number of other things. Nuclear power is under a lot of threat. Hydropower, a lot of people think hydropower is being benign, and to some extent it is, although you still have to build dams, and people don't like damming up rivers and to generate power. Similarly for windmills, you know, wind power is out there, and it's making a contribution, but there's only so much wind power and solar that you can generate around the world. I think the key point here is that the 2 points. One is energy is being used more and more efficiently throughout the globe. If you look at the statistics, we're getting a much higher GDP per unit of energy, particularly as economies advanced from developing stage to advanced economies, and that's very helpful. We're also seeing greater efficiency and energy choices in automobiles. In California today, if you choose, you can buy an electric vehicle. Not many people have taken up that option, but nevertheless, they're there. If you want, you're free to buy a hybrid, which are now being introduced to the market by Honda and Toyota, and I believe Ford is coming out one soon. It's the best of both worlds, a gasoline and electric synchronized engine, if you will, a motor and engine within an automobile. These cars are available in the marketplace, so customers, I think, are going to have more choices than ever before. We're committed to providing the fuels for these vehicles, and I've been working very closely. I would like to remind you, too, that the basic automobile itself, contrary to a lot of public perception, is with today's clean-burning gasoline in California, is almost a new automobile with clean-burning gasoline emits 1/100th of what automobiles used to emit 30 years ago. So we've made dramatic changes, dramatic improvements in energy efficiency and in emissions simultaneously. All of that has been done through technology, through better processing and fuels technology, as well as better automobile technology. And I imagine that those trends will continue during the next decade, and we're going to get better and better and more efficient and cleaner in the process.
We have two questions on a similar subject. One is, Chevron is no longer regarded as a major oil company. Can Chevron continue to go it alone? And the other question is, Chevron a minor oil company or a major oil company?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that question. I can tell you one thing, we're good. There are things out there called super majors. I guess Exxon Mobil would be the consummate supermajor. Exxon was three times our size, about a year ago, and it's four times our size or so today. So, yes, they're a big. I think that's where you're asking. The theme of the question is probably how do we compare to those. I think we compare very favorably. The question of size and competitiveness and ability to generate profitable growth, I think there's no real correlation. If we execute our plans well, we can certainly generate returns and growth in earnings faster than competition. In fact, you could argue that a minor major, a minor supermajor or a major minor, whatever it is in a very good position to compete, can move faster, like we have into the e-economy, for example, than some of the bigger companies. So I'm confident we can be successful. It's no secret that we've looked at combinations in the past. None of them have worked out, and we're certainly not saying we'd never do something in the future, but our plans are based on successfully growing our company, generating shareholder returns, and being better than the competition over the long term.
Okay. As the new guy on the block, we'll say, what advice would you give, I guess, to yourself as a new CEO? How do you see your role, and what things are you going to be bringing to the table?
It's nice not to get a prize question for a change. first of all, I think how do I feel about the job? I'm very fortunate to have had the opportunity to operate in many parts of our company and have some very good mentors and helpers, one of whom is on the dais here to my right. So I feel pretty well prepared. And I'm enjoying the job. It is a little bit more intense when you get in the seat than you think it is before you get there. particularly when oil prices get to $30 and gasoline flirts with $2 in the Bay Area, you get to hear a little bit about all that. But it is. I love this business. I really enjoy it. It energizes me. I think we're kind of overlooked a little bit. I'm an advocate for our organization. I love working with our people. We have tremendous people throughout our company, and I get that feel. I ran into a number of people here today who gave me a great compliments on our relationships with government entities, with business partners, and the like. And I'm energized by it, and I'm looking forward to helping continue the great success that we've had in the past in this future. So thank you.
With all the changes in the oil industry and with all the new internet ventures and just the way the world is changing, what will Chevron look like in 5 years? And I'll follow on and take that a little further with another question, which is, it's 2011. Your successor is giving a talk like yours, and what would he or she say differently? So sort of give us a little picture of the future.
Well, I'm glad you said he or she, because it's true. It could be. I feel that that in the next 5 years we're going to be bigger and better, obviously. But we also are learning so much from technology. One of the things that I can predict with great certainty is we've become a lot more global in the last decade, and I imagine that will continue. You will see a greater mix of nationalities in our own management teams in San Francisco as well as elsewhere than we have had in the past. We are growing very rapidly. Just for example, 5 or 6 years ago, we had no business activity essentially in Latin America. Today, we have a major business unit operating in 3 Latin American countries, contributing enormously to the growth of the company. And we have whole new sets of employees that we didn't have before, with different cultures, different backgrounds, different linguistic skills. So we are going to be definitely more global, more widespread, and we will undoubtedly be doing business in an entirely different way through e-commerce. We're seeing that transition today. So I imagine that 11 years from now, somebody who stands up here, first of all, could be male, could be female, may not have English as a first language, and probably will be very technically proficient and able to express our business in terms that I can't even anticipate. But one thing I do know, that 10 or 11 years from now, the world is going to need energy just like it does today. And it will be essential that we have affordable, reliable supplies of energy available to continue economic growth.
Will Chevron, like so many other large companies, break up its operations into functional businesses and spin them off into separate companies?
Not unless it makes good business sense. Let me give you some examples. The two e-businesses that we've announced, Petrocosm.com and RetailersMarketExchange.com, are both going to be spun off into separate businesses, and Chevron will not have a majority stakeholding in them. We'll probably have a minority position. We think it makes most sense to do that because these businesses are going to serve everybody in the business, and we don't think that they will appeal to others if they're dominated by one or other company. So we find putting a joint venture together, a joint company, we're in it, other companies are in it, particularly other technology companies as well, and business partners make the most sense. So those are clearly businesses that we will run separately. A few years ago, made a decision to bring our gas liquids business and spin it off into a company that's now called Dynegy. Dynegy is now one of the fastest growing power generation and marketing trading businesses in the United States. Its market cap is over $6 billion, up by a factor of three just in the last couple of years. It's growing rapidly, and I think you'll hear more about Dynegy. We chose to take a shareholding position in that in a separate company because we felt we want, no, that is a different market with a different set of dynamics, different set of skills, so we had a good business reason for doing it. So where it makes good business sense, we do it, but for most of our businesses that are core to our competence, we obviously manage and operate those more directly.
Okay, a little different subject here. What is the status of the Caspian Sea pipeline, and how is Chevron currently moving the Tengiz oil to market?
Okay. Tengiz is an enormous oil field with 6 to 9 billion barrels of oil on the eastern shore of the Caspian Sea in Kazakhstan, one of the former Soviet Union states. We have been involved there directly since 1993. When we started, oil production was about 20 or 30,000 barrels a day. Today it's producing about 220,000 barrels a day, up tenfold. We are currently moving most of the oil from that market through a pipeline system, but there is an adequate capacity in the pipeline system to move the oil. So much of the oil is being moved in rail cars, which may seem like an awkward way to move oil, but the former Soviet Union rail system is very big. There are lots of rail cars that are suitable for carrying oil, and we bring it to the marketplace through that. The main purpose of this Caspian pipeline, which will connect the Tengiz oil field all the way to the Black Sea and therefore to tankers that can get it into the world markets more easily, is to allow us to not only move most of the oil more efficiently to the marketplace today through pipelines and avoid the heroic, more difficult ways of getting to the market, but also to allow us to further grow that oil field's production and bring the oil from the current 200,000 barrel a day level to about 700,000 barrels a day, which we intend to be at the end of this decade. This is a very important project. It's a cooperative project with the government of Russia, the governments of Kazakhstan, as well as other business partners. And it's by far the biggest privately organized and run investment in the former Soviet Union. I think it's going to be a good test of where the Soviet Union and Russia in particular is headed. We're very confident. The pipeline is already under construction. A lot of the pipe is in the ground, and more has been fabricated, incidentally, in Russian mills, and very good quality, too. The terminal is being built. We intend to have it the construction complete in 2001 and be shipping oil later next year.
Last week there was a big news story about ethanol replacing MTBE. Now, is this a good idea? And if so, when will Chevron do it?
We already use ethanol in our gasoline in a number of states where it makes good economic sense from a supply and quality standpoint. It's more complex in much of the areas in which we do business because there's a very limited amount of ethanol available. California has an odd situation, as it does in many cases. California has a good set of regulations around gasoline quality called California Cleaner Burning Gasoline is best way to, and it's good. You can make it. It is very low emitting from automobiles, and it's good for the air. It's the equivalent of taking something like 3.5 million cars off the road. It's very beneficial. Unfortunately, the federal government also regulates gasoline and has chosen for regulatory reasons to require that its specifications also be met in the southern half of the state and Sacramento. In that part of the state, we have required to put oxygen in our gasoline. Oxygen can be provided through ethanol if there was enough of it available, which there is not, or MTBE. MTBE is something that is bad for our gasoline. Our customers don't like it. Very small quantities into the water supply, you get odor and taste problems. So we're supporting the governor's proposal to phase out MTBE use in California by the end of the year 2002. We think it's a good idea. We think, in fact, it would be a good idea if it was done nationwide. We don't think it's necessary to regulate oxygen and gasoline. It doesn't do much good. There have been panels of scientists now retained by the government to show that. However, the reality is we're going to need ethanol to ensure that there's gasoline supply, and we're going to need some oxygen and fuel in very special cases. So there is a market for ethanol. We just object to the mandates. We think it's unfortunate. We've solved one problem and creating another. And on long term, I believe that ethanol will have a role in gasoline, but it should be in there on a market basis, not on a government mandate basis.
How many of the Chevron stations in the Bay Area are owned and run by Chevron, and how many are independents? And is there any trend or anything we can take from the information?
I don't have the numbers for the Bay Area at hand, but I think for the San Francisco, city of San Francisco, there are only two or three that we actually own and operate. The others, all the others, are operated by independent business people who are our dealers and business partners. I might add that this is a very challenging job that they face. They face limited opportunity to grow in this city because of the high costs, as I mentioned earlier, and because of the limited ability to add revenue streams to help pay the rent in this enormously high rent area. Those of you that try to buy houses or apartments or rents around here realize what I'm saying. These people face those challenges as well. So I would encourage those of you that have ways of influencing this to help open up their opportunities for being able to conduct a broader line of business on the service stations. I understand it's a sensitive issue because of the small grocers, but somehow we've got to provide more opportunity for these business people to survive independently, or we're going to have even less service stations and less competition in the city of San Francisco. Thank you.
Does Chevron face many of the same problems that most Bay Area employers are facing in terms of finding good people, keeping good people, and how are you dealing with the, 1% unemployment rate here in the Bay Area?
Yes, we are. It's a very difficult situation. We may not be quite as badly hit as some of the high-tech companies, but I know that in our high-tech areas, particularly our information technology folks are in high demand. It's very hard to compete with the dot-com prize. You know, a lot of folks jump over to a startup. there's a relatively little downside, because if they fail, they move on to the next one. And the jackpot is pretty big, so it's very hard to compete with that. And I guess that you might say it's almost impossible. We encourage our people. In fact, we had a conversation about this yesterday. We think it's a good thing to encourage our people who want to try to succeed in the dot-com world or work in some of the new dot-com companies we're involved to go with them. They're independent companies. They offer upside. They're not risk-free. But we think that if we become part of this, we will be a more attractive employer. People will want to join Chevron because they realize this is a road as well to the new economy, and they get good business experience on the way. That's about the only way that we could think of dealing with it, but certainly it is a problem.
How do you feel about Chevron having been taken off the Dow Jones average?
Well, our pride was hurt. We've been on it for since the 1920s, if I recall. But I think that's an indication, again, of the new economy. It hasn't dramatically affected our stock, for example. It's reduced its visibility, unfortunately. That's one thing I think we regret. But they're not much stock or fund tied to the Dow. Most of it's tied to Fortune 500, S&P, and those type of funds. So it's more of a pride thing than anything else. I think the reality is, as the shape of the economy changes, there is less room for, quote, old economy companies. So that's a reflection of the change in the general shape of the economy. It'll be hard to get back on, but maybe we'll get there.
Well, we have time, unfortunately, for just one final question. And, you know, I think a lot of us are sorry to see so many of Chevron employees leaving San Francisco. But despite the departure of many of the operations outside of San Francisco, will Chevron stay actively involved in the community here in San Francisco and maybe shed some light on how you'll do so?
Yeah, we've sold our two buildings on Market Street, and by mid-year we'll have just our corporate center in about 10 floors, 200 people left in San Francisco. The majority of the rest have moved to the East Bay, primarily San Ramon, where we have office space. It's a matter of pure economics. People, you know, I said earlier that 70% of our cost savings go through to the customer, and, you know, $30 a square foot lease rates in San Ramon are a lot better than 65 cents and, yeah, 65, I think, dollar rates here in San Francisco and growing. So it's an economic decision. It's somewhat disruptive, but we recognize our ties to San Francisco. We are very well represented in many of the activities in the Bay Area. We certainly intend to stay connected. You know, Skip being involved here in the Commonwealth Club is just one small example. Our leadership in things like United Way and other very viable activities that are important to the community, we certainly will stay involved in and are committed to doing.
Thank you so much. Well, thanks. Let's have a round of applause, and thanks very, very much to David. So thank you, David O'Reilly, Chairman and CEO of Chevron Corporation, for a very wonderful presentation today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on radio, and invite all of you to join us again soon. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is adjourned.